my pleasure to introduce Paul Olson. Paul is a true Midwesterner, right?
I am.
Born in Wisconsin, raised in Minnesota, educated and worked in Iowa, correct? And there was a little stint in Oregon.
A big stint in Oregon.
Okay,
yeah.
Big stint. So very good. So, and before Paul starts, his book reading tonight, we're moving it to Chalet to Garden level because Kelsey needs to have 60 people for a training. Unless you want to attend a boundaries training, required staff training, you can come here. If you want to hear Paul read, he's going to be in Chalet to Garden level. And I'll kind of post myself there, so that's at 8 o'clock fall. And it'll be actually better because they can go get ice cream easier after Vespers and then go to Chalet, correct?
So yeah, I think to have a reading, you need
ice cream.
It's better
all around,
yeah,
right, very good. So today he's going to talk about modern African-American fiction writers. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. I have changed a little bit from what was on the board, just a little. And I've done so because so many sessions have dealt with introducing us to new ideas and the courage it takes to step out of what you've always known. We've always known Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and now all of a sudden we've got Thomas and many others. And we start to wonder, what's really the firm ground? And we hear about the other, just today in Bussy's class. So I've changed a little bit, and part of what I'm doing is sharing with you a personal journey, but a journey through the stuff you came to hear, that is African-American literature. And I changed it because I just recalled sitting in a class at the University of Oregon. I had been there for a year and a term, and had just finished, get that, I had finished my master's degree. And in that time, I wasn't married, and I just, after every class, I just went and played basketball or studied. And I played basketball with a guy who became my best friend, and he's black, and he's going through the same education canon that I was. And one of the teachers that we were sitting together in this class referred to Richard Wright, and I said to my friend, "Who's he?" Now, I'm done with a master's degree in American and English literature, and I hadn't heard of Richard Wright. I think that's institutional racism. And I think that's the setup of the canon. And then what do you do about that? Well, so part of what I want to do today is talk about the journey I've had through this literature, but we are going to still look at briefly some slave narrative, all kinds of literature that tells us these things. Pardon me? Sure. You can do whatever you want. And talk about these three ideas. And illustrate them with concrete stories in the literature. Our perceptions, our stereotypes, our historical absolutes. Where do they come from? And I'm going to start by reading just a couple episodes from a book of short stories by Richard Wright. And I'm going to ask you, when I'm just reading a couple scenes, what you think these scenes do with regard to perceptions and stereotypes and historical absolutes. And the first one, and I think this book is... my book isn't for sale, but this book is for sale in the bookstore. Four little boys, we don't know their age, but they're probably between 9 and 11, have just decided to skip school. They're black, they're in the South, and they're just kind of, in the first several pages talk about, we're surely, it's made clear to us that they're little, they're somewhat innocent, they do know when they hear a train whistle that it goes to the North. And they do know that up north they got equal rights up there, I hear. But they're little and they're kind of thoughtless and somewhat naive, somewhat. And it's hot, and they decide to go swimming in a pond owned by a guy that they know who's white, and there's a big sign right there by the pond that says no trespassing. And they've been in that pond now, swimming and playing. And far away, a train whistled. There goes number 7, heading for up north, blazing it down the line. Lord, I'm going north someday. Me too, man. They say colored folks up north has got equal rights. They grew pensive. And just note, and I'm not going to stop anymore, let you do the noting, but in this natural, peaceful setting, note how it's set up and how it's interrupted.
And what year are we talking about, or decade?
Well, this is written in 1938.
Okay.
So it's down south in the... But let me add that my favorite line for students is, these stories are not about just about down there back then. Mm-hmm. And I know you know that, but that's a great question, and thanks for asking it. They grew pensive. A black-winged butterfly hovered at the water's edge. A bee droned. From somewhere came the sweet scent of honeysuckles. Dimly, they could hear sparrows twittering in the woods. They rolled from side to side, letting sunshine dry their skins and warm their blood. They plucked blades of grass and chewed them. Oh. They looked up, their lips parting. Oh. A white woman, poised on the edge of the opposite embankment, stood directly in front of them, her hat in her hand and her hair lit by the sun. It's a woman, whispered a big boy in an underbreath. A white woman. They stared, their hands instinctively covering their groins. Then they scrambled to their feet. The white woman backed slowly out of sight. They stood for a moment, looking at one another. Let's get out of here, big boy whispered. Well, wait till she goes away. Let's run. They'll catch us here naked like this. Maybe there's a man with her. Come on, let's get our clothes, said big boy. They waited a moment longer, listening. What the hell? I'm going to get my clothes, said big boy. Grabbing at short tufts of grass, he climbed the embankment. Don't run out there now. Come on back, fool. Bobo hesitated. He looked at big boy and then at Buck and Lester. I'm going with big boy and get my clothes, he said. Don't run out there naked like that, fool. You don't know who's out there. Big boy was climbing over the edge of the embankment. Come on, he whispered. Bobo climbed. 25 feet away from the woman, there she stood. She had one hand over her mouth, hanging by fingers. Buck and Lester peeked over the edge. Come on back. That woman's scared, said Lester. Big boy stopped, puzzled. He looked at the woman. He looked at the bundle of clothes. Then he looked at Buck and Lester. Come on, let's get our clothes. He made a step. Jim! The woman screamed. Big boy stopped and looked around. His hands hung loosely at his sides. The woman, her eyes wide, her hand over her mouth, backed away to the tree where their clothes lay in a heap. Big boy, come back and wait till she's gone. Bobo ran to Big boy's side. Let's go home. They'll catch us here. Big boy's throat felt tight. Lady, we just want to get our clothes, he said. Buck and Lester climbed the embankment and stood indecisively. Big boy ran toward the tree. Jim! The woman screamed. Jim! Jim! Black and naked, big boy stopped 3 feet from her. We just want to get our clothes, he said again, his words coming mechanically. He made a motion. You go away! You go away! I tell you! You go away! Big boy stopped again, afraid. Bobo ran and snatched the clothes. Buck and Lester tried to grab theirs out of his hands. You go away, go away, go away, the woman screamed. Let's go, said Bobo, running toward the woods. Crack! It's written in all caps, and it's a gun. Lester grunted, stiffened, and pitched forward. His forehead struck a toe of the woman's shoes. Bobo stopped, clutching the clothes. Buck whirled. Big boy stared at Lester, his lips moving. He's got a gun. He's got a gun, yelled Buck, running wildly. Crack! Buck stopped at the edge of the embankment. His head jerked backward. His body arched stiffly to one side, and he toppled headlong, sending up a shower of blood into the bright spray of the sunlight. The creek bubbled. Big boy and Bobo backed away, their eyes fastened fearfully on a white man who was running toward them. He had a rifle and wore an army officer's uniform. He ran to the woman's side and grabbed her hand. You hurt, Bertha? You hurt? I just want to remind you to get this in a sense. These are little kids, 9 to 11. She stared at him and did not answer. The man turned quickly. His face was red. He raised the rifle and pointed it at Bobo. Bobo ran back, holding the clothes in front of his chest. Don't shoot me, mister. Don't shoot me. Big boy lunged for the rifle, grabbing the barrel. You black son of a bitch! Big boy clung desperately. Let go, you black bastard! The barrel pointed skyward. Crack! The white man, taller and heavier, flung Big Boy to the ground. Bobo dropped the clothes, ran up, and jumped onto the white man's back. You black sons of bitches! The white man released the rifle, jerked Bobo to the ground, and began to batter the naked boy with his fists. Then Big Boy, striking the man in the mouth with the barrel, his teeth caved in, and he fell, dazed. Bobo was on his feet. Come on, Big Boy, let's go. Breathing hard, the white man got up and faced Big Boy. His lips were trembling, his neck and chin wet with blood. He spoke quietly. Give me that gun, boy.
Whew.
The scene doesn't end there, and I'll tell you how it ends. But I'm interested in what your reactions are to all that you heard. And my favorite line about literary analysis, I have two favorite lines. One is, it starts in your guts. What does your heart feel? What do you just feel emotionally as you hear the story? And we'll get to the head, from the guts to the head. And the other one is, just look closely. You don't have to find anything symbolic. Just look closely and tell the truth. What have you heard? And I'll help you out a little bit. Are you hurt, Bertha? What are your thoughts as you hear this episode? Why would he? So, okay, wait. What is your name?
Rita.
Rita, thank you.
I think fear and hatred like Flash.
First thing, like Flash, great phrase. L-I-K-E. Fear. Hatred. What's he afraid of with 10 little kids? I mean, they're barefoot. They can't even kick them. Okay, good. Are you hurt, Bertha? What else did you hear? What's the first thing that happens once the white guy gets down there?
He shoots somebody.
I'm going to continue the day with my own journey that was stimulated a lot by the recent, starting in 2012, with all the white cops shooting black kids. Mm-hmm. What is that about? And it prompted me to write a paper about that, and I'm going to share that. To see what goes back in our history that makes us say, like a flash, fear and hatred. Well, that's the first reaction. And we know then, too, are you hurt, Bertha? What do you think of that? Is it irrational fear? That
I think they're getting it with their mother's milk. That fear and hatred, so they've never even thought about it. They've never thought, why do I hate and fear black people? It's just like they grew up learning that with their ABCs.
You just gave, the greatest response to this. These are historical absolutes. If you see black, you're afraid. When we drive into the city, the Chicago Bears play football, we roll up our windows on the south side. What is that about? I'm told by a friend of mine who's a cop in Rock Island. I teach at Augustana College in Rock Island. Don't run on 11th Street. All you have is your shorts and your t-shirt. You can't do it. 11th Street is the West End. 11th Street is the Black District. Anything else? How about, and we'll move on. How about the, go ahead. What's your name again?
Eris. The line that's most indicative to the dynamic in the relationship is, give me that gun, boy.
Yeah.
Because at this point, he's shot two of his friends, he just got his teeth knocked out, and he still has the authority to say, give me that gun, boy, as if he's going to give it to him.
We have a phrase for that in today's talk about the cops and the communities, and it's, what is it, white superiority? Yep. And privilege, for sure.
Respect. Really is supremacy, too.
All those things are right. Supremacy, superiority, privilege.
Respect.
I don't have to think about it. I can just shoot. And then we'll see as I look back at our historical run through African-American and white relationships. There's really no accountable. It starts way back in slavery. I can shoot my slave, he's my property, just like I can dump my wagon in the river and never have to get it again, it's property. I wrote in my notes as I looked at that story again today that I knew you would answer well, and this is great stuff, but this is, what we're seeing here is, I would call them social and economic because of that privilege and power, but all these things, those are the consequences of these kind of perceptions. There's another depth to it, and it goes into the next story I'm going to read, into the spiritual consequences. And in this story, the protagonist, his name is Silas, and he's, is this thing? Yeah, there we go. He's away, he's made it in 1940. He's got a farm, and he's even going to hire a hired man, because that's what the white people do, and I'm going to bring back money, and I'm going to bring my wife, he has a wife and a baby, I'm going to bring her a gift when I come back, and because that's what we do. I mean, that's what we do as what? The guy that brings home the bacon. And while he's gone, a white kid, a college kid selling gramophones, comes to the house at the farm and slowly talks to this woman, Sarah, and ends up raping her. And Silas comes home, the white guy is gone, and through a kind of a long, complicated conversation and walk through the house, Silas finds out what happened. She didn't tell him because she knows what Silas will do. He'll hunt him down and kill him. He doesn't think that. He thinks, if you're going to start sleeping with white men and not telling me, and that whole scene, he's discovered that she has been raped. And she wants to just get out of there. But Silas says, go home, get your things, and go to Aunt Peel's. He was going to keep her safe. But this white man is coming back to get the rest of the money that was down paid or paid down on the radio. And so he knows he's going to come back. So he throws these clothes, baby clothes, out of the door, and Sarah cries, Silas! She cried, seeing blurred objects sailing through the air and hearing them hit softly in the dust. Get your things and go, Silas. Ain't no use in saying nothing now, but they'll kill you. There ain't nothing I can do. And there ain't nothing you can do. You done too goddamn much already. Get your things and go. They'll kill you, Silas. He pushed her off the porch. Get your things and go to Aunt Peel's. Let's both go, Silas. I'm staying here till they come back. She grabbed his arm and he slapped her hand away. She dropped to the edge of the porch and sat looking at the ground. Go away, she said quietly. Go away for they comes. I didn't mean no harm. Go away for what? They'll kill you. It don't make no difference. He looked out over the sun-filled fields. For 10 years I slaved my life out to get my farm free. His voice broke off. His lips moved as though 1,000 words were spilling silently out of his mouth, as though he did not have breath enough to give them sound. He looked to the sky and back to the dust. Now it's all gone. Gone. If I run away, I ain't got nothing. And if I stay and fight, I ain't got nothing. It don't make no difference which way I go. God, God, I wish all of them white folks was dead. Dead, I tell you. I wish God would kill them all. She watched him run a few steps and stop. His throat swelled. He lifted his hands to his face. His fingers trembled. And then he bent to the ground and cried. She touched his shoulders. Silas. He stood up. She saw he was staring at the white man's body lying in the dust in the middle of the road. He'd already killed one of them. She watched him walk over to it. He began to talk to no one in particular. He simply stood over the dead white man and talked out of his life. Out of a deep and final sense that now it was all over and nothing could make any difference. The white folks ain't never give me a chance. They never give no black man a chance. There ain't nothing in your whole life you can keep from them. They take your land, they take your freedom, they take your woman, and then they take your life. He turned to her screaming. And then I get stabbed in the back by my own blood. When my eyes is on the white folks to keep them from killing me, my own blood trips me up. He knelt in the dust again and sobbed. After a bit, he looked to the sky, his face wet with tears. I'm gonna be hard like they is. So help me God, I'm gonna be hard. And when they come for me, I'm gonna be here. And when they get me out of here, they's gonna know I'm gone. If God lets me live, I'm gonna make them feel it. He stopped and tried to get his breath. But Lord, I don't wanna be this way. If you don't fight, it don't mean nothing. If you do fight, it don't mean nothing. Either way you die, and it don't mean nothing. Responses?
Well,
from your heart, from your guts. Good.
Both the stories illustrate power over, this, using sexuality as the power over another people. I mean, as soon as that white woman showed up on the, you knew these kids are, you just could see that one coming.
But, and they knew too, didn't they?
Yes, they did. That's right. That's right. And this door-to-door salesman, that was power over, and not so much sexuality.
So we have this one more step about power. Others. It's a great response. You know the Emmett Till story?
Yeah.
5, 14 years old, kid from Chicago, had white friends at the Chicago school and went south. We don't really know what he said, but he whistled at a black woman, or he said, here's my friends. But the husband of the woman that he talked to said, we're going to go get little Emmett Till and take him out and beat him to death and throw him in a river and tie him to a fan. But they found him. And they were acquitted. Anything else? You know the white, so that story, you know, they know that. And it goes back to slavery, and you'll hear it in a second. Anything else?
Helplessness. Just feeling like there's just no other, no other way.
Wow. What a feeling. You die if you fight, you die if you don't fight. Either way, it don't make no difference. How do you get power? I saw one, I think. Okay. All I can see is a light into the window.
Okay, just institutional racism in all of its forms. I mean, you know that not only the people in your community can take your freedom away, but the system is fixed against you. So even if you have proof in a court of law, you are disenfranchised. And this is post-Reconstruction when there was hope.
I've added a word to that, and it's a great response. This is institutional racism, and it's also attitudinal racism. And you can talk all day long, what does racism really mean, and what's the difference between bigotry and racism. But they contribute to each other. The institutional racism contributes to bigotry, and you know, which comes first. This thing keeps falling off.
As long as you talk long enough, we don't
care. I can do that. Quick lesson. This story, this book, was the first book that this guy with a master's degree at that time had ever read by a black writer. I remember lying on the beach at the Pacific Ocean in Oregon, and I read this. I was alone. And I just put it on my chest and sat there for I don't know how long and said, why didn't I know this? Why wasn't this part of my, I know Hawthorne and just rattle off all the American lit people. And I didn't even know who Richard Wright was, let alone know this journey that black people have made throughout our history. That, my history with that, I think can relate to the American journey. And I've written this paper, and I want to go straight through it. You can interrupt me anytime. But I'm trying to take us on this tour through the literature and through my own personal responses as I became acquainted, like all of us are on this journey one way or another, and what do I say, how do I say it, how do I think, where did that perception come from? We just try to chase that down. I started with this sentence. The black experience in America is different. And that legacy shapes the perceptions and behavior of all of us. That started, sentence, out of my looking back on my own and probably all of our, one way or another, education after the murder of Trayvon Martin in Missouri. And so these perceptions...
Trayvon Martin was murdered in Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Brown.
It's all right.
Tell me.
Michael Brown.
And those perceptions and the behavior of all of us, whether you're a professor in Rock Island or a cop in Ferguson, Missouri, or, I wrote then, an athlete in Iowa. A long time ago, a really long time ago, when I was a 400-meter track runner in college, I wrote a poem about an encounter of my own flawed perceptions and assumptions about race. Here's that poem. I kicked the cinders from my spikes, stretched my legs into the starting blocks, looked to my left at my teammate. He was the reason I had lots of runner-up finishes. 30th in the whole world he was. But then I looked to, So I always ran for second against the other mortals. Once when he wasn't in the race, I ran to win. I did too. And the usual taste of blood, the staggering legs, and the hammering heartbeat were small prices to pay. And today, he was there again, on my left, sure to lead at the first turn. I hadn't even looked to the right. He was the only force. But then, a glance right changed everything. Stretching into the blocks in lane 5 were the longest, blackest legs I had ever seen. Oh God, slipped from my lips. And I reviewed every Olympic sprint I knew. Jesse Owens' legs were skinny and his jersey hung loose, but he showed Hitler how to run. Bob's 9.9 was the world's fastest, and the Dallas Cowboys brought him up even faster. John Carlos in his fullback torso, legs like oak. Tommy Turner and Ray Sadler, skinny, seventh grade small, wisps like grass. Tommy Smith, sleek, defined, NBA tall. Such different bodies, such common skin. Black beat white, absolutely, always. My pale skin legs stretched hard, slamming my foot into the blocks, fearing third. Third was okay. I'd done it before, but always at the finish line, never before the gunfire. I won the race for second. 49 seconds it took. 100 years erased by a cinder track and the taste of blood. To undo the done is a bloody thing. Most black writers demonstrate for us that this change, this awareness, this dissolution of our absolutes is a violent process. Sometimes physically, always spiritually. And then I started this journey through Missouri and Minnesota, and these thoughts about perceptions come to me out of the continued distress over the many episodes with police and black communities. My friend Linda gave me hot water and honey.
And cayenne and lemon.
Oh, well, I'm set.
It's the best.
It really works. From the White House to the streets of many American cities, the New York chokehold and death of Eric Garner converged with the Ferguson shooting of Michael Brown to create protest marches and to stir a national conversation about racial justice. Previous cases were added to the mix when a white former police chief was charged with murder in the shooting of an unarmed black man back in 2011. In Cleveland, the U.S. Justice Department found that officers too often used excessive force. In Madison, Wisconsin, another white cop killed an unarmed black teen named Tony Robinson. Over the ensuing months, many more names became familiar. Dontre Hamilton in Milwaukee, John Crawford in Dayton, Ezell Ford and Dante Parker in California, 12-year-old Tamir Rice and Tanisha Anderson in Cleveland, Akal Gurley in Brooklyn, Tony Robinson in Madison, Eric Harris in Tulsa, Walter Scott in North Charleston, Freddie Gray in Baltimore. It's a long list. Everyone following the Ferguson episode quickly took sides. Some said the cop was a racist, gun-toting, reactionary murderer, and the kid was an unarmed teenager trying to surrender. Others argued the cop was doing what he was assigned to do, protect the public, and the kid was a dirtbag punk who shouldn't have ignored or challenged a police officer's orders. In New York, the cops were threatened by a big man resisting arrest. Many thought the man was unarmed and just trying to breathe. Others said, if he could say, I can't breathe, he could breathe. The reactions among many of the local black residents were angry, vulgar, destructive, and violent. The reactions of the police force brought out tear gas, rubber bullets, armored vehicles. Hysteria, indeed. Ferguson was no small go-away-soon newsman. This incident brought the U.S. Attorney General to town, prompted speeches by the governor, motivated outside activists to deliver speeches and sermons, moved the President of the United States to speak directly to the entire country, and then form a task force to develop new training techniques for police officers. The President then asked Congress for $250 million to supply body cameras on cops everywhere. With only rare interruptions, CNN covered it for hours and days, including reporters, politicians, forensic experts, doctors, sociologists, and historians, all analyzing and trying to explain the hows and the whys. One video of a citizen measuring the distance between the police car and the dead Michael Brown went viral. Across the country, college classes discussed the historical and social forces at work, while churches from New York to LA and in the Quad Cities where I lived held candlelight memorial services. One cop, one teenager. Yet this story pushed the deaths of thousands in the Ebola crisis to the back pages. Consciousness is raised. But how does America make sense of all of this? How do I make sense out of all of this? For me, I have my entire professional life wondered about the literary canon that until relatively recently favored mainly white male writers. My perceptions are continually challenged. One personal example was my somewhat close relationship with William Styron, Pulitzer-winning author of The Confessions of Nat Turner and the writer of Sophie's Choice. The Confessions of Nat Turner was his historical novel about the leader of a famous slave revolt in 1832. But how does the imagination of this white Southern author help to shape a reader's perception of a black slave? Questions continue to pop up, and I still today ask myself and my students, who decided my perceptions for me? I was in college in the early 60s and was just then beginning to navigate my way through the subtle yet powerful assumptions about race that permeated my hometown and perplexed me even as a child, while my prejudice I grew up with was with Native Americans. I was in Minnesota and we had a reservation just outside our town. And while wrestling with my own formerly unconscious, now conscious, participation in racial discrimination, injustice, and oppression. Today, in 2019, in universities and colleges across the country, in churches and law offices, police stations and courtrooms, in the New York Times and NPR, and in college students' dining halls, questions are asked, perceptions are examined, explanations are coming from all directions. Maybe Richard Wright, and here's our journey. The author of those gripping short stories from which I just read, way back in 1937, told us why. In his essay, Blueprint for Negro Writing, he flatly states the obvious, that in our America, there is a Negro church, a Negro press, a Negro social world, and there is, he says, a Negro way of life in America. And get this part. Note the word Negro, he's writing in 1938, and that was the proper word. This Negro way of life that they, quote, did not ask for, and which is forced upon them from without by lynch rope, bayonet, and mob rule. 1937. 2019. Wright argues that black and white America must get to know others and, quote, accept the concept of this segregated world. Even more, America must understand the effects of this segregation, especially the erroneous perceptions. And my own personal journey through all this might be America's journey today. So it might be helpful to go back to the beginning, or at least to the beginning in America with the enslavement of Africans. The African leaders who shipped slaves across the Atlantic seem to have given little thought to the long-range consequences of their acts. Leslie Fischel and Benjamin Quarles, in their documentary History of the Black American, tell us that in pre-European Africa, quote, slavery carried no stigma of innate inferiority. A slave could often rise to a position of trust and honor. And this indigenous slavery was on a, quote, relatively small scale. However, on this side of the Atlantic, in just 350 years, West Coast Africa lost an estimated 24 million of, I'm quoting, its best physical specimens, the only kind the slave traders wanted. Thank you, Linda, for this. Subsequently, the Europeans tried to invent racial theories to justify their business. Theories suggesting that Africans were natural slaves and were inferior. Or they created theories based on phrenology, that pseudoscience that attempted to prove that Africans were less intelligent based on the shape of the brain. Also influential, I think about my history teachers that studied history and maybe read this book. Also influential was a study entitled American Negro Slavery, published way back in 1918 by a guy named Ulrich Phillips, that enhanced these rationalizations. Phillips argued against slavery for economic reasons, but ironically contributed to slavery's justification with his conclusions that, and I'm quoting him, slaves had an eagerness for society and merriment. They had a fondness for display, person, dress, emotion. They had a not flagrant sensuality. Are you hurt, Bertha? Are you okay? A receptiveness toward any religion whose exercises are exhilarating. He said this. An acceptance of subordination. A readiness for loyalty. A healthy human repugnance toward overwork. These perceptions of a contented slave or the Sambo character come from Phillips's sources that were really mainly court records and white testimony with no sources from black people. One of his sources concluded, quote, that slaves do not go about looking unhappy and are with difficulty, I fancy, persuaded to feel so. And another recalls meeting a slave who, quote, seemed not to know he had a right to be anything but a slave. The condescension suggests inferiority, and these erroneous perceptions clearly are, then, an example of we just never knew their stories. Nevertheless, seriously flawed as it is, one scholar said that Phillips's study had the most profound influence upon the historical study of slavery. And I asked my friend, why don't I know that? Who taught me that? Who shaped my perceptions? But these condescending perceptions weren't just the opinions of racist exploiters, They were long before couched in the laws of the land. In 1712, for instance, South Carolina passed an act for the better ordering and governing of Negroes and slaves. And part of this act meant, quote, that Negro houses could be searched every 14 days for better ordering of these slaves. And upon complaint made by any justice of the peace, they could be arrested. They said, this justice did, that they can issue a warrant for apprehending the offenders. And is it fair, I asked then, writing this paper, to ask if these laws and their enforcement would have anything at all to do with the police officers who 3 years ago encountered a man with a rifle in Kalamazoo, Michigan, who refused to identify himself, grabbed his crotch, and flipped them the bird. The man was white. Police took 40 minutes to talk him down before they took away his gun. He was not arrested, and the next day his gun was returned. 3 months later, in a different city, a 12-year-old black boy was playing with a plastic but realistic-looking toy gun when police arrived. This is the now famous Tamir Rice incident. One officer jumped out of his car and shot him. There was no attempt at talking the boy down. We have a phrase that applies to these scenarios too, white privilege. Can laws that shape perceptions that in turn shape behaviors create consequences 3 centuries later? Maybe a character in a more modern fictional work argues that something that had been enacted over thousands of square miles in over 300 years is not just perception or injustice, it is an accomplished fact of life. These acts for ordering Negroes and slaves served as a model for slave codes that became predominant throughout the slave states. Every slave state had one. I own the Code of Tennessee, and it contains thousands of laws inside. It's 8 by 10 by 2 inches thick. But even earlier, only 12 years after the founding of Jamestown, and a year before the Pilgrims arrived, John Rolfe recorded that a shipload of blacks had arrived, and the tobacco planter, quote, sold us 20 Negars who were indentured servants, not slaves. We all know what an indentured servant is, right? You buy your passage by, I'll give you 7 years of my servitude. But distinction between servant and slave soon became based on race, and we have this recorded by John Rolfe. It's in the 17th century English. Whereas Hugh Gwynn hath brought back from Maryland 3 servants formerly run away, the court doth thereby order that the 3 said servants shall receive the punishment of whipping, and to have 30 stripes apiece, one called Victor, a Dutchman, the other a Scotchman, James Gregory, shall first serve out their times left with their master according to their indentures, and the 1 whole year apiece, and 1 whole year apiece after the time of their service is expired. And after that service, they'll serve their colony for 3 whole years apiece. And the 3rd, being a Negro named John Punch, shall serve his said master or his assigns for the time of his natural life here or elsewhere. Arbitrary? Irrational? Soon to follow were more irrational laws like prohibiting white women from marrying slaves. If they did, they too would serve the slave's master. So, laws reinforced perception, perception reinforced the law. For example, the Tennessee Slave Code, get this, Article 1, Section 2619 reads, all assemblages of slaves in unusual numbers or at suspicious times or places not expressly authorized by the owners are unlawful. They shall be dispersed by any patrol of the district or by any person. Many of these laws categorize the slaves as suspicious and potentially dangerous, fearing that, I'm quoting, the carrying of clubs and other mischievous weapons may give them an opportunity of executing wicked designs and purposes. The first reaction. Clear lines of white authority. And one has to wonder today if that kind of history has anything to do with why white people roll up their car windows as they drive to a Bears game, or why joggers in Rock Island are told to stay away from 12th Street? Or does this history have anything to do with a cop not even considering talking down a black kid with a toy gun? And then there is the literature growing out of this historical setting and working its way through American culture. Even anti-slave literature sometimes idealized treatments of the noble savage, the noble savage theme, by imaginatively identifying themselves with persons they had never even seen. One thing that means is that some white people wrote slave narratives and made it sound like part of what you said from Ulrich Phillips. They want to be slaves. They don't know any better. But John Little, a fugitive slave who had escaped to Canada, said long ago in 1855, "'Tisn't he who has stood and looked on that can tell you what slavery is. 'Tis he who has endured." And I think of anybody in our culture who has been designed as the other, 'tis not he who looked on, or she who looked on, but she or he who has endured. Enter autobiographical slave narratives. All these inaccurate perceptions, so influential in shaping behavior toward black people, had to be rewritten. First, to let America do more than hardly know who you are or to not have ever heard your story, and next, to tell the truth, not manipulate perceptions. A colleague of mine once explained good writing this way: look closely, tell the truth. Slave narratives were a beginning of new perceptions because they did tell the truth, and they were indeed written by people who endured, not by those who looked on. These authentic slave narratives reveal the physical horrors of slavery, as when Olaudo Equiano talks about heavy iron hooks hung about their necks, or when Frederick Douglass tells readers about the shrieks of his aunt, who was whipped until she was covered with blood. While the louder she screamed, he quotes, the harder he whipped. And there are psychological horrors, especially the fear of being sold and separated from family. James Pennington tells of when, I'm quoting, his mother and older sister and myself were given to a son of my master. And this occasioned a separation between my mother and the only two children she then had, and my father to a distance of about 200 miles. He later says, it is this that throws one's family history into utter confusion and leaves him without a single record to which he may appeal in vindication of his character or honor. The slave William Craft says that his wife could not bear children because, I'm quoting him, the mere thought of her ever becoming a mother of a child, to linger out a miserable existence under the wretched system of American slavery, appeared to fill her very soul with horror. Linda Brent, a slave living with a master who demanded her sexual favors, knew that her master was, quote, the father of 11 slaves, and she recounts what it is, I'm quoting her, to be entirely unprotected by law or custom, to have the laws reduce you entirely subject to the will of another. Within these narratives, the perceptions that a slave is content, or that a black woman does not know she has a right, or that a slave is a savage because he revolts, these perceptions are turned upside down. But many other perceptions remain. That too, those perceptions too, lead to quick judgment, thoughtless reaction, and violence. The slave narrative is not the only literature attempting to raise consciousness. African American fiction writers, playwrights, essayists, poets, they all consider the history, the laws, and the social mores of American culture that define our perceptions and determine our actions. One poet recalls, once riding in old Baltimore, heart-filled, head-filled with glee, I saw a Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. Now I was 8 and very small, and he was no whit bigger. And so I smiled, but he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until December, and of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember. 1 8-year-old remembers only the nigger slur. The other knows only that a black boy is someone he can detest. Our history is replete with countless lynchings and too many deaths similar to the 1955 murder of Emmett Till, or the killing of Trayvon Martin in 2012, or the shooting of Michael Brown in 2014. Indeed, the legacy of slavery and the acts triggered by perceptions invented over the centuries significantly contribute to how these events can happen, and how the actions of the individuals are directly influenced by their perceptions. And so we read African-American fiction. An early scene in Wright's Depression-era novel, Native Son, illustrates how these perceptions influence behavior. Bigger Thomas is the chauffeur for a family whose rebellious daughter, Mary, wants to be driven to a black restaurant so she can, as she says, see how your people live. Obediently, he drives Mary and her boyfriend, Jan, to Ernie's kitchen shack, but he stays in the car as they head inside. They ask him, "Aren't you coming with us, Bigger?" I don't want to go in," he whispered. "Aren't you hungry?" No, I ain't hungry. Come with us, sit with us anyhow." I, Bigger stammered. "It'll be all right," Mary said. Reluctantly, he joins them. Jan leads them to a corner table and says, "Sit down, Bigger." Jan then orders three dinners. And under the watchful, curious eyes of the entire restaurant, which is all black, Mary exclaims, "This is simply grand." Mary and Jan nonchalantly eat away. And the narration reads this. Bigger picked up a piece of chicken and bit it. When he tried to chew, he found his mouth dry. It seemed that the very organic functions of his body had altered. And when he realized why, when he understood the cause, he could not chew the food. After two bites, he stopped. "Eat your chicken," Mary said. "It's good." Then Jan and Mary pepper Bigger with questions about his life. "Where were you born? How far did you go in school? You like it in Chicago? You live with your people? Where's your father?" Through it all, Bigger is self-conscious and ashamed. They are wealthy white people, indifferent to and casual about their position in the world, curious about his. He lives in a one-room apartment with his mother and two siblings. A curtain divides the kitchen from the beds. The bathroom is in the hallway, shared by other tenants. Mary lives in a million-dollar mansion with a second-story servant's quarters that includes a bathroom. A separate floor has a kitchen with a full-time maid and cook. Mary and Jan are free to leave Ernie's kitchen shack anytime and go home to their world of freedom and possibility. They are free to go anywhere and eat anything. They never think of their whiteness. It doesn't even cross their minds. The Bigger is black is all that Bigger thinks of. The whole scene demonstrates the victim status of Bigger. But more importantly, maybe, the questions they ask Bigger show that there is no uncertainty about their perception of black people. They're black people on the south side of Chicago who quit school, abandon their kids, want to live in the ghetto, and I ask no wonder Bigger can't even chew his chicken. The complexity of social oppression is the focus of a radio play. I'm almost done. A radio play written when radio was an essential source of dramatic entertainment. The play is a dark comedy about Carl Owens, a young black man desperate for a job so he can save the mortgage on their home. His last resort is to dress in his wife's clothes and respond to a newspaper ad for a black maid. He knows black women can get a job more easily than a black man. He knows he'll get away with his disguise because, as he says, "Who looks that close at us black people anyhow?" We again might think of, we don't know him, we haven't heard his story, because the whole play exposes perceptions that force a man to masquerade his very manhood. Disguised as Lucy, Carl gets the job but does not count on the amorous advances of the chronically half-drunk husband of the household, Mr. Fairchild. Nor does he count on being asked to wash the back of his mistress as she bathes. Black man with a naked wife, you get it. Carl's initial response to his mistress's request is a poignant, "Huh?" Lucy, who of course is really Carl, is well acquainted with the assumptions made about black men and white women. He would know why Emmett Till was murdered. He would know all about the castrations and lynchings that killed too many black men accused of, as the language implies, messing with white women. However, except for the stuttering and profuse sweating, nothing unusual occurs as he scrubs her back and his masquerade remains intact. The disguise is, in fact, so effective that Mr. Fairchild, who assumes all black women are promiscuous, tries to fondle Lucy Carl. Mrs. Fairchild enters the scene and, in disgust and jealousy, shoots Carl, wounding him in the groin. They call a doctor, who subsequently examines Carl's wound and, of course, exposes Lucy as Carl. The Fairchilds are at first disturbed that Carl washed the back of a naked white woman. But they are even more distressed that Carl made no sexual advances toward her. That challenges all of their assumptions. Carl, of course, has been unmasked, but exposing the idiocy of those white assumptions about black sexuality is the unmasking that most troubles them. So, they not only ignore Carl's imposture, but also pay him hundreds of dollars to keep the entire sham quiet. Carl returns home able to pay off the mortgage, but when he tells his wife the whole story, they cry, as the narration reads, with bitter shame at their degradation. And I asked, to what moral consideration can they appeal? They have $200, but the old perceptions remain. For the Fairchilds, racial certainty is their fixed star, their absolute, their certainty, their solid water. In one of my favorite biblical metaphors, can they walk on the water and leave the firm ground? Their racial certainty is their fixed star. Black men and want white women, and black women are promiscuous, and these assumptions are certainties. Biases have slipped into all our brains, says a science journalist at the Washington Post, and I'm quoting him, "We all have a responsibility to recognize those biases and work to change them. But even in the face of America's recent racial incidents, we avoid any change." Listen to a couple of the more popular arguments to preserve the present reality and prevent our society from achieving this social consciousness. Bill O'Reilly says there's no such thing as white privilege. Rush Limbaugh says that, quote, "There's a mindset out there that only people of color can be victims. A white person," he says sarcastically, "can never be a victim." New York's medical examiner officially called Eric Garner's death, the guy that was killed, a homicide. The grand jury said no charges. Agree or disagree, these responses avoid even thinking about, let alone questioning, the complex perceptions that contribute to these recent events. This leads me to the conclusion of my paper. John Keats, the 19th century British poet, suggests that the journey to truth leads through uncertainty, mystery, and doubt. Therefore, it seems that the historical, cultural, or philosophical dogmas that have long shaped perceptions about a world that for too many is impossible to live in must be questioned. And by questioning these perceptions or even acknowledging their existence requires intelligence, imagination, and courage. Can we refuse the absolutes? Can we lift our voices? Can we walk on the water? The American journey.